From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a bailout for a bankrupt Greece all hinges on a Sunday referendum. A no vote could lead to Greece's exit from the euro. Greek voters are split.
Saying yes is to help Greece, not because we like what's going on, not because we agree with these measures, but because we think it's better than going bankrupt.
After more than half a century, the U.S. and Cuba declared their respective embassies will reopen later this month. A watershed moment for U.S.-Cuba relations.
This is a historic step forward in our efforts to normalize relations with the Cuban government and people and begin a new chapter with our neighbors in the Americas.
And the U.S. on heightened alert after warnings of extremist attacks this 4th of July weekend.
July 4th is a symbol of America, right? What better to strike than a symbol of America?
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Alex Eisenstadt of Politico, David Sanger of The New York Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What's your top story? Iran, Greece, presidential politics? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Vienna, where he's been covering the Iran nuclear talks this week, is New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger. Welcome back to On Point, David. Nice to have you.
Great to be back with you, Jane. Greetings from Vienna.
Thank you. And from Washington, Alex Eisenstadt is with us. He's a political reporter for Politico who's been covering the 2016 candidates. Alex, nice to have you as well.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, David, and Alex.
So let's talk first about those security warnings. The FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and the National Counterterrorism Center have issued a joint bulletin to all local law enforcement across the country, reminding them to, quote, remain vigilant during the upcoming national holiday and military events due to the heightened threat of attacks, end quote. Here's former CIA Deputy Director Michael Morrell telling CBS This Morning that these warnings should be taken seriously.
I wouldn't be surprised if we're sitting here a week from today talking about an attack over the weekend in the United States. That's how serious this is.
David Sanger, this is the highest threat alert we've seen, I believe, in a long time.
It is, but it's also the hardest kind to go defend against. I mean, lone attackers are, as we've seen, unfortunately, in many cases, hard to handle in malls, in schools, in prison breaks. So you can issue this alert to law enforcement, but I'm not sure that there's an enormous amount they can go do about it.
There have been numerous arrests in the last couple of weeks, terror suspects in New York, one suspect apparently collecting information about building a pressure cooker. FBI Director James Comey talking about a shift in this focus from tracking Americans who are radicalized perhaps abroad to those who stay home to plot their attacks. Alex Eisenstadt, what do you make of this?
Well, look, you know, it's a country right now that's really nervous. And one illustration of this happened on Friday here on Thursday here in Washington, D.C., in the Navy Yard, which was the site of a shooting just a couple of years ago. You had a situation on Thursday where someone working in the Navy Yard area heard construction happening. They thought that it might be gunshots. And so 911 was called, and you had an enormous police presence descend on the Navy Yard area. And Washington, D.C. is a city that is now really on really heightened state of alert throughout the city, the Capitol Hill area, and everywhere, really. And so, it's something that people are very much on guard about this 4th of July weekend.
Here's former Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis reiterating that the security concerns are real.
You have the Secretary of Homeland Security come on and say that this is the most serious threat since 9/11. Those comments have to be taken seriously.
There is particular concern with an ISIS spokesman's urging supporters to attack during the holy month of Ramadan, Jack, which ends July 17th.
Yes, you know, this looks set to be a permanent feature of our lives, I'm afraid. We've been at this, 14 years, the war on terror. In President Obama's first full year, 2010, worldwide, 13,000 people were, there were 13,000 terrorist fatalities. Last year, there were 32,000. Mm. It looks as if the war on terror is producing more terror. Mm.
David Sanger, let's move to Iran. You've been reporting on the Iran nuclear talks there in Vienna all week. Talks were extended until next Tuesday, a full week after the original deadline. Do you have a sense whether momentum is building for a deal here?
Well, there's momentum, but it's easy to confuse momentum with progress on the hardest issues. You know, when you do a negotiation this complex, and this is far, far more complex than, say, any arms control agreement we ever reached with the Soviets or later on with the Russians, because it involves so many moving parts, so many facilities, 18 facilities alone in Iran, and so many national arguments about sovereignty and whether or not inspectors could get onto military bases and whether foreigners can go interview Iranian scientists who may have worked a decade ago or more recently on weapons projects, that the accord, if it happens, will be very long and probably pretty hard to figure out. There are four or five major annexes to the agreement as drafted now. We've seen a lot of foreign ministers come and go. There are more in town today, and they say they're coming back on Sunday. And so the aim is to have a final agreement by Tuesday or so. But that would mean getting past three big issues, Jane: the timing of sanctions relief, the kind of research and development Iran will be able to do on nuclear work in the interim of this agreement, the 10 or 15 years that it is largely in force, and finally on the very difficult question of whether or not Iran is going to have to fully come clean with what it did in the past, or whether we can focus on the future. Mm.
Right. And Iran's supreme leader has declared that foreigners could not enter military sites or interview Iranian scientists. Pretty hard on that one.
He did in a speech about a week and a half ago. But if you read the speech carefully, it also has this odd line in it saying that, no one can engage in unconventional inspections. So we were asking a very senior Iranian official yesterday who was briefing some of us, what would be a conventional inspection? And he started talking about Iran agreeing to go along with a set of protocols that 120 countries have signed up to that the International Atomic Energy Agency uses, which would allow, in some circumstances, inspectors to go onto military bases. So there could be some movement in there. The Americans make clear that's not enough, that there has to be more, a much more specific access agreement.
During a break from talks in Vienna on Wednesday, Secretary of State John Kerry told reporters that the Iran nuclear talks were making some progress.
We are working very, very hard. We have some very difficult issues, but we believe we're making progress, and we're going to continue to work because of that.
Alex Eisenstadt, what kind of pressure is President Obama getting domestically to seal this deal?
Well, you know, it's interesting because this is something that is going to be a major political issue in 2016. Of course, foreign policy is going to be is a very big deal, and it's something you're hearing about Democrats and Republicans talk about. One thing, though, on the campaign trail, and this is sort of interesting, is that we don't know a whole lot about how any of the candidates, Hillary Clinton, or for that matter, the over dozen Republicans who are running, what they think about this issue. We don't know a whole lot in detail about that. And we don't know a lot about what their general approaches to Iran would be for any of these candidates. And so this weekend, whether we have a deal or whether we don't, it's going to provide some kind of window potentially into what those views are.
Jane, if I could just throw in on that point.
Please.
Certainly for the Republicans, most of them have said they wouldn't trust any deal with Iran. And they have many of them have made the case that President Obama shouldn't have even gotten engaged with the Iranians. Now, that does not take into account what happens if you do nothing. In other words, if Iran, which is already 2 to 3 months away from being able to produce one weapon's worth of uranium at any given time, if you just let the thing go, you might be in worse shape. But for Secretary Clinton, this would be a very hard deal for her to walk away from, because remember, the secret diplomacy with Iran that got this process going started under her watch.
So, Jack Beatty, hard deal to walk away from then, I presume, in your mind?
Well, the Obama administration has a great incentive, and the Iranians don't. This week, David's colleague Tom Friedman wrote, the Iranians don't believe we would go to war over this. Is that so, David? Is there really a sense that we're just simply bluffing when the president says there will be no, nuclear Iran under his watch?
Well, it'd be pretty difficult for the Iranians to race ahead and build a bomb under his watch, just given how much scrutiny their program is under. You can always be surprised, but right now it looks like it would take them a considerable period of time. The question is, if the United States believed Iran was right on the cusp of a weapon, would it take military action or join Israel in military action? And I think one of the complaints that people have had about the Obama administration is that they think that the president has not been convincing that he would actually be willing to take that action. But he also hasn't been tested on that because the Iranian program has been basically frozen in place for the past 18 or 20 months while these negotiations have gone on. So he has not had to go issue any kinds of threats. And even the Israeli threats of military action have receded a bit while these talks have happened.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a busy week in the news, and you can join the conversation. How do you explain Trump's bump in the polls, Bernie Sanders' huge crowds? Can Chris Christie break through? What are you thinking about overtime pay, ISIS, the Supreme Court? Alex Eisenstadt is with us from Washington. He's a reporter for Politico. David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times, also with us from Vienna. And On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Let's go to Greece now. Hours after telling Europe that he could accept most of the conditions of a bailout he previously rejected, Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras urged Greek voters to reject new bailout terms in Sunday's referendum.
I call upon you to say no to the prescriptions of the memoria, which I want you to answer no for a viable solution to Greece, to open a new bright page in our history.
In an interview with Bloomberg TV on Thursday, Greece's finance minister said he would step down if his country votes yes on Europe's bailout proposal.
So if there's a yes vote, come Monday night, you will not be finance minister?
I will not.
Right. Okay. So this is kind of make or break for you.
But I will help whoever it is in order to push it through that building over there, the Greek Parliament.
David Sanger, a lot of twists and turns in Greece this week. European leaders warning that a no vote in this referendum could plunge the country into, quote, economic freefall. How do you see this going?
It has been sort of interesting to be here in Vienna because the same foreign ministers who are coming in and out on the Iranian nuclear talks are meanwhile trying to hold together the whole European project. And, of course, they're twin fears, which are contradictory, are first that Greece will leave the European currency and that would be the first time that any country adopted the euro and then left. And then on the other hand, when you sort of sit them down and talk to them about it, they sit and moan that they never should have let Greece in to begin with because Greece has not been willing to put up with the kind of fiscal constraints, and they all sort of turned and looked the other way when there was too few taxes being collected, too many debts, and then deficits running up. And now, after 2 years of bailout plans, they are not really persuaded that this Greek government would be any more successful than the previous ones were in actually making those plans work. And they have some sympathy for the Greek argument that the austerity put in place by the International Monetary Fund has actually contributed to the shrinkage of the Greek economy.
Mm. Let's get a caller on this point. Charlie is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Charlie. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, please.
My question was, I read Paul Krugman quite a bit. And I understand the Keynesian arguments that he has for a place like Greece. But what I have trouble understanding is if they don't make the necessary changes and they don't set up a viable system, aren't we just throwing money away by giving them the big, continuing to give them the bailout if they're not going to do the necessary reforms? Why not just cut to the chase and stop bailing out the Greek government? It sounds as stupid as voting for Scott Walker for president.
Charlie, thank you. Jack Beatty, no reforms, no bailout? What do you say?
Well, you know, just going back a couple of years, David mentioned this, there were articles about tax collection in Greece, and prominent physicians would declare their income was X, and then surveys of their property would show a swimming pool and an extra apartment and their foreign travel. It almost sounded like there was a national malady. We don't pay, you know, we don't pay taxes, a kind of Pakistani situation. Well, you know, I'm a European creditor. I'm going to look at that and say, do I really want to give these people more money when they're not even collecting from their own wealthy?
Let's move on to politics. Jack, thank you. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie jumping into the race this week. Two presidential hopefuls, actually, Chris Christie and Virginia Senator Jim Webb. Alex, I know you've been covering the candidates for Politico. You were at Christie's presidential announcement earlier this week. What's his playbook? What's the momentum going here?
Well, Christie was once considered a future Republican frontrunner, and now he's really fallen back to the back of the pack. He's had this precipitous drop in his fortunes over recent years, over the Bridgegate scandal and so on. And what he's really trying to do is he's trying to present himself as the guy who's going to tell it like it is. He's going to be the straight shooter, and he's going to bring his full New Jersey persona to this race, love him or hate him. And he's going to try to wear it all on his sleeve. And, you know, we'll see how this works. He's staking his campaign on New Hampshire. It's really essentially a one-state campaign. And he's presenting himself as, you know, a Northeastern Republican who's going to run in the Northeast. And in the past, presidential candidates who've staked their claim on one state haven't done very well. We saw Rudy Giuliani tried this in 2008 with Florida. His campaign kind of blew up. So, you know, we'll see how this works out. You know, Christie could surprise some people. He's a compelling persona. He's a great public speaker and a great political performer. But he's certainly not the front runner that he once was.
Here he is, Chris Christie, promising straight talk when he declared his candidacy for president in Livingston, New Jersey.
I am not running for president of the United States as a surrogate for being elected prom king of America. I am not looking to be the most popular guy who looks in your eyes every day and tries to figure out what you want to hear, say it, and then turn around and do something else.
Chris Christie, but you know who got the biggest crowds this week was Vermont Senator and Democratic hopeful presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders. Here he is at a rally in Wisconsin delivering a stump speech to a crowd of nearly 10,000.
Tonight, we have more people at a meeting for a candidate for president of the United States than any other candidate has had in 2016.
Claire in Madison, Wisconsin saw him there. Claire, what do you make of it?
Hi, Jane. First of all, a small correction. There were 10,400 people, and they were turning him away at the door.
Okay.
He was wonderful. Part of his message was, the Republicans are trying to portray me as an extremist. He is not an extremist. His message resonates with people. He's excellent.
Claire, thank you. Here's Jordan in Austin, Texas. Jordan, what do you make of Bernie Sanders?
Hi, Jane. I was originally on the Hillary bandwagon for a long time, and I was talking with my sister yesterday up in Oregon. And I think it's really interesting, just his positions, and I think it makes a lot of sense for America right now. I'm just curious if it's actually possible to get him versus the Clinton campaign.
Jordan, thank you. Jack Beatty, a recent poll has Sanders actually gaining on Hillary Clinton in Iowa. Clinton's lead is also dwindling in New Hampshire. What do you make of this?
Yes, in New Hampshire, within eight. In Iowa, he seems to have doubled his support just in the last month. So there's a Sanders surge, and he's raising money. I think the average contribution I heard on Vermont Public Radio was something like $30, which is, you know, virtuous. I don't think Hillary Clinton with her $45 million can quite make that claim. So, yeah, something is working for Bernie, and it has put Martin O'Malley completely in the shade. And almost certainly it's going to force Hillary Clinton to... well, perhaps to move to the left on economics, talking about taxes on the rich, perhaps talking about a transfer tax on speculation on Wall Street, and she's going to be pressured on her vote for the Iraq war.
Mm. Well, and then there's Donald Trump this week seeing a surge in his polls in national and early primary state polls like New Hampshire and Iowa, despite or maybe even perhaps because of all the controversy surrounding him. Alex, is there an audience for this kind of rhetoric that we're hearing from Donald Trump?
No, not really. I mean, look, Donald Trump he's not going anywhere in this race. He is a showman. He's a performer. And he's great at getting attention for himself. But, you know, these superficially high poll numbers we're seeing for Donald Trump are just that. They're superficial. And at a certain point, the sort of rhetoric that we're seeing from him, it's going to start wearing thin on the Republican electorate. And you're likely to see those numbers that he's having in early states like Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. They're going to start to fall fairly soon, I'd expect.
First Univision, then NBC, then Macy's. And Serta became the latest companies to distance themselves from Donald Trump this week after Trump made those disparaging remarks, controversial remarks about Mexican immigrants. Here he is speaking at the City Club of Chicago on Monday, Trump responding to the backlash.
There's no apology because what I said is right. I mean, what I said is 100% right. There is tremendous distress on the border. You know that better than anybody. The Mexican people are fantastic. The relationship I have with them is great.
Here's Howard Fineman tweeting from the Huffington Post today. Here in New Hampshire, Trump is no joke, working the phones, donating to causes, sending Ivanka. Angry conservatives see him as a potent anti-establishment outsider. Jack Beatty, Democrats must be delighted.
Oh, they're ecstatic. The good Lord must be a Democrat with a sense of humor, quipped one strategist. Hillary Clinton is slyly making Trump the face of the GOP. She told her Virginia rally, quote, "Recently, a Republican candidate for president described immigrants as drug dealers, rapists, and criminals." Trump, the Washington Post wrote, is dangerously toxic to the Republican brand. And, you know, by severing their connections with Trump, NBC, Univision, Macy's, and the others, they may only be helping him hurt the GOP brand. This is Rich Lowry writing of the National Review. He says, there are a few things that benefit a Republican candidate in the current environment of left-wing bullying more than getting fired and boycotted for something he said. Chris Christie is supposedly said to be eager to confront Trump in next month's GOP debate. But Christie,
if he makes it to the debate.
Yeah, he may not have the poll numbers to make the cut. You know, not since the age of Pericles, give or take a millennium, has a politician presented a more inviting or deserving target.
Here's David in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, David. Welcome to On Point.
Yeah, hi, Jane. I think that the Trump bump is more about name ID than anything. I think I'm a Republican. I'm a conservative. I can't imagine Trump getting more than 5% when people actually went and voted. Once the candidates come out, once they put their positions out. And anyway, I'm a Scott Walker supporter, so I guess I'm stupid.
David, thank you. Scott Walker actually expected to join the race later this month. Alex Eisenstadt, there are now 14 announced Republican candidates in this race.
That's right. And in a couple weeks, we'll be getting our last Republican candidate. John Kasich is going to be announcing in his home state of Ohio. And so it's a big field, and we don't know exactly how this is all going to play out. I will tell you, though, that Democrats are really relishing this Republican fight. You had Barack Obama go to Scott Walker's home state of Wisconsin on Thursday and started talking about how this was a clown car and how it's starting to resemble the Hunger Games. So, you know, Democrats see an opportunity here for this to sort of turn into a divisive Republican fight for the nomination that they hope will eventually leave the GOP nominee fairly damaged. Hmm.
Well, let's turn now back to Washington for a moment. The White House used this month's job numbers to underline President Obama's new proposal to expand overtime pay to millions of American workers. Small business owners express some concern. Republicans say the proposal will hurt job creation. Here he is, President Obama, at a rally at the University of Wisconsin yesterday, pitching his plan for overtime pay.
This is an issue of basic fairness. If you work longer, you work harder, you should get paid for it.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of this one? Is the White House aiming too high, too low here?
Well, you know, any wage increase for anybody beneath the mogul class, it's as welcome as it's rare. Unemployment in June fell to a 7-year low, but wages were flat and the workforce participation the lowest in 38 years. The Obama administration has increased taxes on top earners, but the gap between the rich and the rest has only widened. 400 Americans now possess more wealth than 80 million Americans. In his excellent book, Are We Rome? My friend Cullen Murphy quotes a historian who puts Rome's decline and fall into three words: fewer had more. In a news analysis, the Times praised the president's overtime plan, but said more was required and listed some of the steps that need to be taken to keep us off the Appian Way. Unions need to revive, but next term, the Robert Courts looks set to geld public sector unions. The rich need to pay more taxes, but the Republican Congress won't raise taxes. Mm. There must be massive new public investment in infrastructure to create good-paying jobs. Congress can't agree even on a modest highway building program. Meanwhile, Oxfam predicts that next year, the combined wealth of the top 1% will exceed the total wealth of the other 99%. Mm.
David Sanger, what do you make of this overtime move in Washington this week?
Well, the most interesting thing is that it's another example of President Obama trying to move ahead with his agenda, even though he knows that there aren't the votes in Congress. So he's doing as much as he possibly can by executive action. I was White House correspondent for the Times at the end of the Clinton administration, and you saw President Clinton do the same thing. The risk of these kinds of actions, of course, is that if they are executive in nature, they can get overturned by the next president. So it's a bet that Hillary Clinton would get elected and would keep these in place. That said, it plays right to the income inequality elements of the Republican field and why Hillary Clinton is trying to move to the left, not only to cut off Bernie Sanders, but because she thinks that the Republicans are really going to divide on this question of whether income inequality is a major issue for the campaign. Mm. And surprisingly, you have now heard a number of different Republican candidates out of that field of 14 or so begin to talk about the issue. That didn't happen the last cycle around.
It's true. As Alex Eisenstadt, you didn't hear that before.
You didn't, and interestingly enough, I was with Mitt Romney a couple of weeks ago, and this, is, of course, was an issue that really was the downfall of his campaign. You know, the Democrats really brutally cast him as someone who was blind to income inequality. And he seemed to suggest that this was one of – Romney seemed to suggest that this was one of his problems and one of the things – one of the reasons why maybe he lost that race. Interestingly enough, the fact that Obama was in Wisconsin was no accident. They want to – Democrats want to highlight Walker's record on employment issues and his battles against unions and the working class. Mm.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We have other news this week. Nicholas Winton, the man who became known as the British Schindler, died on Wednesday. He spoke with 60 Minutes correspondent, the late Bob Simon, about how he helped hundreds of Jewish children escape Prague as Nazis marched on Czechoslovakia.
took a bit of blackmail on my part.
You were indulging in blackmail and forgery to get the children out.
I've never heard it put like that before. It worked, that's the main thing.
And if you're lucky enough to take a tour of the White House now, you can snap a selfie. The White House lifted a 40-year ban on photos and cameras this week.
And here we go, there's one smile again. Good.
Everybody's taking a picture, huh?
And the USA heads to the Women's World Cup final this Sunday. The soccer team will face off against Japan after their win against Germany.
Kelly O'Hara makes it 2-0 with a little over 5 minutes to go. Surely no way back for Germany now.
And you can join the conversation. Is your heart aching as black churches burn in the South? Are you on board with the investigation into airline industry price collusion? Are you ready to cheer on Team USA at the World Cup? Alex Eisenstadt is with us from Washington. He's a reporter for Politico. David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times, is with us from Vienna. And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. I do want to bring up these terrible church fires this week. Here's some sound. Donica Simpson speaking with NPR in Warrenville, South Carolina, where authorities continue their investigation of a fire that destroyed the Glover Grove Baptist Church, one of six black church fires that have taken place in the past week and a half since those nine people were shot dead at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston.
I actually think it might be a hate crime. The way things are happening these days, you never can say. Look how they went up there and shot someone in the church or other churches burning down. It's just so much going on in the world. You never know.
We don't know the cause of these, Jack Beatty, but it's such an awful sight.
It is an awful sight, you know. And since the end of the Civil War, when blacks began to build their, freed slaves really, began to build their own churches, racist whites have attacked them. And they've done it, you know, to stir a fear and to set back black progress. And no, we don't know what caused all of these, but it is such an ominous thing and with such ominous parallels in our history. Of course, the worst moment of all, the 1963 Birmingham church bombing that killed four girls. And by the way, the suspects in that, the four suspects were only convicted in 2002 for that murder.
Well, we had big rulings also this week from the Supreme Court. Obamacare, of course, same-sex marriage. Another ruling surrounding redistricting, Alex Eisenstadt, may directly impact your beat. Tell us about that one.
Well, one of the sort of major issues confronting congressional politics is the issue of redistricting. You know, the way House congressional districts are drawn now is that they favor – drawn to favor politicians. Politicians draw lines – to protect other politicians who are in Congress. And so there's been a big push to reform that and to take the drawing of lines out of the hands of politicians. And so the Supreme Court upheld an Arizona law that would create an independent redistricting commission, which is similar to what we've seen in states like California. And so this is a big deal. And the question now is there going to be a sort of a nationwide push to have independent redistricting commissions? A former congresswoman from California named Ellen Tauscher is talking about starting a campaign to wage such a push. But, you know, this is a big deal because so many people are unhappy with the way redistricting works and how it sort of protects incumbent politicians in the House.
David Sanger, your take on the Roberts Court after this monumental week.
Well, it's been, as you said, a remarkable period of time, and one that I think conservatives are still a little bit in shock about, particularly after the two big rulings, certainly the one on gay marriage, where it was seemed clear where the court was likely to go. But in any case, having the finality of that was one people were having a hard time figuring out how to go respond to. But while liberals were celebrating, if you look at the docket of what's coming up in the court in the next term, just the cases that they accepted, you have to wonder whether or not we will be interpreting the legacy of the Roberts Court a little bit differently after some of the larger cases, including a big one on affirmative action that will be coming up next term.
Jack Beatty, your views on this court and these huge rulings this week.
Well, you know, people have been talking about the liberal Roberts Court, and in fact, it's been the most liberal term of a court since the Warren Court in 1969. But to David's point about next year, yes, affirmative action looks like it's hanging by a thread. Second, there's going to be this public sector union case that could well set back unions in public sectors. Basically, it would allow people to free ride on the unions. They wouldn't have to pay dues if they didn't want to because there would be a violation of their free speech. That looks like it might well go the conservative direction. And finally, one man, one vote. That's going to be up for review, and some people are beginning to say the court that gave us, you know, $1 one vote under Citizens United may well change that formula such that it benefits rural America and hurts metropolitan and urban America. Mm.
Another big story this week that was overshadowed by some other news, but President Obama formally announcing that the U.S. is renewing diplomatic relations with Cuba, calling on Congress to lift the longstanding embargo. Here he is, President Obama, on Wednesday announcing that embassies in Havana and Washington will reopen later this month.
This is not merely symbolic. With this change, we will be able to substantially increase our contacts with the Cuban people. We'll have more personnel at our embassy, and our diplomats will have the ability to engage more broadly across the island.
And then speaking with CBS News Miami on Wednesday, Republican Representative Ileana Rose Leighton of Florida said President Obama is making a big mistake by reopening U.S. and Cuban embassies.
What we want is change, real change in Cuba, and then we'll lift the embargo when we have freedom and democracy. And we wish that the president would have done more in his years of his presidency to get allies to join us in this fight.
David Sanger, what do you make of these renewed diplomatic ties with Cuba?
You know, it is the most remarkable experiment in diplomatic engagement that we've seen, with the possible exception of the one I'm witnessing out here with Iran. The fundamental bet that President Obama is making is one that is quite different from the one that the Congresswoman has suggested. She suggested that if you basically keep the sanctions in place and could get our allies who have been walking away from the sanctions to continue with a Cuban embargo, Cuba would somehow change. President Obama's argument is, we have tried that every year since the second year of the Kennedy administration. And when something fails for half a century, maybe it's time to try another approach. So now Cuba is finally closer to the model of what we did, what President Nixon did with China, which was open up relationships that then ultimately led to a diplomatic relationship. The difference is there's a lot less risk in the Cuba case. Cuba has not been a strategic threat to the United States since the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. And so the downside risk of attempting this is pretty low. And as President Obama himself said, if you're a country of the size and with the strength of the United States, you don't have a whole lot to be scared about with Cuba. So this is a bet about a Cuba that changes after Castro dies. And that's essentially what he's engaged in.
Let me pivot here for a moment to talk about the major coordinated attacks in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula this week. ISIS may have seized control of the territory, which is just miles from the Gaza Strip. So, David Sanger, do the attacks on the peninsula signal some sort of escalation in which, in which we sort of see now what ISIS is capable of?
Well, they certainly have been a lot more coordinated than people had expected. They ended up taking the Egyptian security forces, who suffered some pretty grievous casualties, by surprise. They're on the Sinai, an area where in the past you have these big resort hotels, out along the beach out there, and then just miles away you have where these attacks have been taking place. It poses a real threat to the Egyptian government, and it poses a very big challenge to the Obama administration, because it's very difficult to get President Sisi, a former general, to end this huge crackdown he's had on everyone from the Muslim Brotherhood to other suspected leaders, these trials that have had mass death sentences and so forth, when his government feels so under siege. And so we've ended up back in the situation we were in the Mubarak era, where we are allied with a government that we very much need, but whose human rights record is exactly the opposite of what we've been urging.
Mm. Jack Beatty, does Egypt have the ability to contain this the insurgency?
Well, the performance of the army, of course, they were surprised, makes one wonder. On the other hand, that's where our aid goes, doesn't it? It goes to the army. It's just the process, the sort of dialectic that David is talking about that's so worrying. The ISIS threat leads to more repression, which leads to more disaffection, which leads to more support for ISIS, which finally, you know, in the past, the terrorist threat is extruded. And, of course, Mohammed Atta was an Egyptian. And similar pattern, really, in Saudi Arabia. We're right back where we were before 9/11, supporting wholeheartedly the, quote, regimes.
Mm-hmm. Let's get some other news in here. Go up to New York State. The New York prison break story, 12 employees placed on leave after two convicted murderers escaped. There are a host of correctional officers and prison executives, including the superintendent, who've been placed on leave. Law enforcement sources say that a public corruption investigation was launched into allegations that prison employees smuggled heroin into the prison to be trafficked among inmates. Here's an interview with NBC on Tuesday. Clinton County District Attorney Andrew Wiley addressed criticism of the corrections employees who helped two convicted murderers escape last month.
These two men came up with an incredible, Hollywood movie script. I take back the critics of the correctional facility. There may be some bad apples in the bunch, and we need to weed those out.
To the other coast, California Governor Jerry Brown signs a new vaccination law, one of the nation's toughest. California joins Mississippi and West Virginia as the only states to ban vaccination waivers based on religion. And then we have these unemployment numbers. U.S. Employers added 223,000 jobs in June, and the unemployment rate fell to 5.3%. It's a 7-year low. Job growth has raised economists' expectations that perhaps the Fed will soon boost the key short-term interest rates here in the United States as early as September. Alex Eisenstadt, how do you see these economic numbers?
Well, it's certainly giving the president a bounce in his step. You know, people have been saying these last couple of weeks have been fairly good for the president. You have the Supreme Court rulings, which we just talked about a little bit earlier. You have some improving job numbers, and so it's giving the president sort of a foundation to sort of lay the groundwork for establishing what his legacy will be. That's what presidents think about in the final 2 years of their office, and so it's been a fairly rocky ride for the president over these last 6 years. But he may have some things he can talk about in terms of advances on gay marriage, in terms of maybe an improving economy, things he can bring forward these last couple of years as he heads into the final couple of years of his tenure.
Well, the economy in the South will be getting a boost. Officials in Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana announced an $18.7 billion settlement with BP on Thursday that resolves years of litigation over that 2010 oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Of course, one of the worst environmental disasters in the U.S. BP will pay about $14 billion for response and cleanup and about $4.5 billion in penalties. After a settlement of the criminal case with the government. Jack Beatty, this couldn't come fast enough for many people who have suffered tremendously since that spill.
5 years and counting. It's just been awful for them. Now, environmentalists have criticized this. They say this doesn't go nearly far enough, that the damage was to life down there. It was, species were just too great. It'll take years and so on. But I'm encouraged. I was listening to a Louisiana legislator talk about it, and I was encouraged by what seemed the foresight he was displaying. He said Louisiana is going to spend this money or a lot of it on trying to prevent the next one. I mean, they're actually going to go in to try to, revive some of those wetlands and all the things we turn, the ecologically sound ways of containing these threats rather than the Corps of Engineer ways, which is just to pave it and hope for the best.
Let's come back, David Sanger, full circle to you there in Vienna, the talks in Iran, the nuclear talks. Tell us where we go from here and what do you expect to see as we move forward?
Well, I think the critical day to look at is probably Monday night or Tuesday. The administration is up against a congressional deadline. If they can't submit a full agreement with Iran to Congress by the 9th, and it would take a few days to transmit all the details of that, the review period in Congress goes from 30 days to 60, in part because Congress is on recess for so long in August. But that means you'd have 2 months of roiling debate about whether this was a good deal, a bad deal, and so forth. And while President Obama almost certainly could get the deal through Congress using his veto powers, in the end, he doesn't want an ugly fight on this one.
Well, many thanks to a terrific panel this hour. David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times. He joins us from Vienna. Thanks for taking the time on a busy day, David. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, and happy 4th.
To you, too. Alex Eisenstadt, reporter for Politico. Thanks to you, Alex.
Thank you.
And Jack Beattie, On Point News analyst. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you, Jane.
Continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Have a safe and happy 4th, everyone. This is On Point.